World Cup format chat, Ireland v Zimbabwe, America's under-19s, the Pacific Games, Nepal in Malaysia, and a whole lot more around the world, and now on the 91.3 Sport FM network. Welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Cricket Podcast, where we dissect the news and events from cricket's new world. Great to be back with you wherever you are listening to this podcast, at the home of sport in Perth, 91.3 FM, and throughout the world listening wherever you do get your podcasts. Full compliment again today, and a special guest. We've got a globetrotter without the Harlem bit, Tim Cutler. Tim, how are you? And more importantly, where are you?
Back in Brisbane. I've just spent all of 66 hours in San Francisco for a wedding. Back in time for work this week, so raring to go.
So you did a day trip to the US, basically.
Every Facebook status of Tim Cutler is actually just a check-in.
I don't know how to take that, but I thought I got better, but apparently not.
Also tonight, our man known by many on Twitter as Copernicus Cricket, Nick Skinner. Nick, how's things?
Firmly grounded back in the Central Coast. Nothing so exciting as the Napa Valley.
I thought you might still be in transit in Jeddah Airport, actually.
That's just where I go in my nightmare.
And let us never speak of Jeddah Airport again.
And a little drum roll here. Our emerging cricket representative in Ireland for the last week or so, Tasneem Summer Khan. How are you?
I'm great, guys. How are you?
No, fantastic. Let's jump straight into our first topic for this week. And of course, we can't talk about cricket without talking about the World Cup final. As fantastic as it was, and what an advertisement it was for cricket, I can't help but think that it's sort of sticky taped over the format of the tournament. I think it's pretty important to note that Scotland last year actually beat the now World Cup champions. As we said, an amazing game of cricket and a great advertisement for the game. But we needed to talk about the format, and at least it needs to be reassessed at some point. I'll start with you, Nick. What do we do? Is it, are people now sort of blinded by the final result? They've sort of forgotten about the round robin stage?
People, we have this, I guess it's part of this innate human desire for narrative, I think, you know, wanting something to be wrapped up neatly. And so when we look at the World Cup and we see this amazing finish, although I think the boundary countback is nonsense, but that's a whole nother can of worms. Pretty tempting to look back at this World Cup and only see the knockout stages. You know, the New Zealand semi-final was fantastic as well. And so we'll look back and see that and think, wow, what a great World Cup. It gave us these great matches. But really, the format of the knockouts is completely independent to the format of the group stage. And, you know, every World Cup ever has had a final. So what happens in the knockouts is, in a way, irrelevant to the group stage format. You know, what if we got this ending to the 2015 World Cup? Would everyone have been saying that, oh, well, the 2015-14 team format, well, that's the best format ever because it gave us this amazing final? Well, no, because the final is not related to the group stage format.
Well, you know who we have to thank for not giving us a bunch of dead rubber? Right?
Well, England's stuffing up, yeah.
Sri Lanka, I was going to say, but okay, I'm alone in a sea of Australians, I get it.
Yeah, Sri Lanka played well. That's true. Malinga, yeah, wound back the years. That was a really good effort from them. I'm not taking anything away from them, but they did finish seventh in the tournament.
They really did.
Well, what it all comes down to, I think we've had an amazing knockout period, as short as it was, with three games if we count the final, that it could have been even better with more teams that have never been more competitive than ever before. So amazing World Cup final, not an amazing World Cup format.
So I'd maybe jump in and add a little bit of my experience here. I have found an awful lot of people coming at me with, oh, you're right, there should be more teams. And why did nobody talk about this before? Of course, all of us and a whole bunch of other people have been talking about this for, what, 5 years now? Maybe even a little bit longer than that. It's not, we didn't just find out that there were going to be 10 teams just before the World Cup started. It's been a long-standing issue. But I think that it has opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that 10 teams is not enough. People suddenly realized, hang on, where's Zimbabwe for the first time since, what, 83? Not in the World Cup. Where is Ireland? What, like, people remember Ireland for knocking out massive teams, knocking out England, knocking out Pakistan. And people are kind of getting a little woke to this, especially with the Scotland-England match last year.
Would you say they're getting Chris woke to it?
Yeah, oh no, no, stop this.
That's way too much full member content already.
Yes.
Yeah, well, the thing for me is like you could have had four quarterfinals if you had a 14 or a 16 team tournament, and who knows, out of those four matches you could have had four cliffhangers. And to say that this was a 10 team tournament that started at the end of May, to put it into perspective, I was still 7 days into my holiday when the World Cup started, and that was what, at the end of May. Like, it feels like an eternity ago that the tournament started. Look, honestly, there are way too many good formats out there being theorized. Russ Degg and had one. We've all kind of tried our best into coming up with one that befits a World Cup, but also does it in a good amount of time, and it sort of includes a whole bunch of teams. I think cricket can sort of look to netball at the moment. Netball have a 16-team World Cup going on that's just started, and admittedly, like, there are challenges that cricket face that netball won't. For example, the length of each match. But as Peter Della Penna said in our podcast with him, people can walk and chew at the same time. They can watch two games concurrently. It's not difficult now with a television and a stream elsewhere. So it's definitely food for thought. We know that in 4 years' time, they are sticking to a 10-team format, barring a miracle. So hopefully this discussion will continue in the upper echelons of the ICC, and we might be able to get some change. Let's move now to Ireland and hosting Zimbabwe in a one-day series and a T20 series. The tour's just concluded with the T20 series ending actually in a one-all draw. Of course, the first T20 international was washed out without a ball bowled. Ireland were able to complete a green sweep in the one-day internationals. Taz, how was it over there watching this and commentating? We heard you with Andrew Leonard as well, providing a really good perspective of things. How did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was great. It's always amazing to be involved in Irish cricket. They're super welcoming, and it was the first time I was back after the Malahide test. So it was really enjoyable, and it was the first time that I'd been to the North too. Slightly different atmosphere, slightly different cricketing vibe, which was really good. But I think it was really nice to, because Ireland are in an interesting phase, aren't they? Where they're starting to phase out some of that golden generation of cricketers that they've had for a very long time, and starting to bring in some younger blood. So I think it's great to get to see that. Not a lot of teams do that well. It's easy to chop and change too much, and to try and be a little bit too dramatic about that generational shift. But I think that they've done a really good job of it. It's good to see a mix of some of the younger guys, like James McCollum, who played really well, Mark Adair, and then, you know, some of the more experienced fellas like your KOBs, like your Porterfields.
Well, to pick up on that, I have been really impressed with Mark Adair as that quick bowler and batsman who can hit the ball big. Quite a great type of player for limited overs cricket. I know that he'll probably be able to do a job in the longer format as well. But
almost filling that Trent Johnson role, isn't he?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, we've seen a lot of guys at the moment. It's kind of a sort of in vogue, in the fashion sort of role, where we've seen number eights who can hit the ball and sort of come in the latter overs or the latter stages of games and provide a bit with the bat, and then obviously some quality fast bowling as well. Lorcan Tucker is another player who's just coming through, like McCollum. But players like Balbirnie, who have been there for a few years, obviously his one-day international stuff was fantastic. And we saw Sterlow and Porterfield go past 4,000 runs in one-day internationals in the series as well. And we spoke to William Porterfield after his side's 3-0 one-day international series win and his personal milestone of 4,000 one-day international runs.
Yeah, it's pleasing to have passed 4,000 runs in ODI cricket. The big thing about the week was we got winning 3-0. I think that's the most pleasing thing from our aspect, especially going 2-0 up, but to see it through and round off a great week to finish 3-0 was fantastic effort from the lads. We played some very good cricket throughout the week. So one of the biggest things from our point of view is the young lads that have come into the side, not only this week but over the season, really, is making contributions, and they're looking like they belong in international cricket. So that's only going to deepen our pool of players. And so it's from the last 10 ODIs at home, that's been one of the most pleasing aspects, is the young lads are coming in and not looking out of place, and as I said, putting in match winning performances, which is great to see, and it puts us in a great position.
Taz, did I hear that you were lost in the forest?
I did get lost in the forest one day. And Nick actually warned me, don't get lost in the forest. And I was like, no, it's fine. I don't get lost places. I don't know what you're talking about. But
yeah, I got a taxi.
Yeah, I was like, please, I'm too bougie to get lost places. I did get a taxi. And then like it dropped me off in the wrong place. And then there were these gates that were locked. I don't know why they did that. And I was wearing these absolutely ridiculous heels. I ended up one day trying to escape the cricket, which doesn't happen a lot, by climbing a fence in heels and a jumpsuit. Maybe like, let's say three drinks down. I'm a little person, that's a lot of drinks. yeah, it was great.
Yeah, the thing about Stormont is, let's just say they haven't got great signage. I got the bus to the game when I went to the washed out game against the West Indies, and it dropped me off at the bottom of the hill going up to the Northern Irish Parliament. So I was just wandering around the grounds of the Parliament looking for a cricket match, which nobody seemed to have any idea was going on. And then I found this little path into the forest, and I thought, well, it seems like it's in that direction. And after about 10 or 15 minutes of wandering aimlessly through the trees, I came to this fence that was blocking my access to the cricket match. So I just kind of crawled under it as opposed to going over it. And there I was.
I'm sure there's a metaphor there for global cricket there, isn't there? With you wandering blindly through the forest and still having to climb under a fence.
Well, with some high-quality full-member cricket in years to come, you'd hope that, yeah, perhaps they might be able to afford a little bit more signage around at Stormont. I've just noticed, just looking at the scorecard of that last T20 international where Zimbabwe did taste victory for the first time on the tour of Ireland, our man Paul Sterling was unfortunate. He copped the first bowler from Sean Williams. Apart from that, they set Zimbabwe 172 for victory, and Zimbabwe looked quite comfortable. Hamilton Mazakadza, seemingly the only player to miss out. He had a bit of a horror tour, it must be said, but Brendan Taylor, Craig Irvine, and then Williams with the bat scoring 58 from 30 balls. When they turn it on, Zimbabwe, obviously they've had a pretty awful tour, but you've got to say that when they do put it together, they're a quality side still.
Throughout the ODIs, they were relatively tight, or at least two out of the three of them were. They were relatively tight games. One of the matches went straight down to the last ball. They weren't as one-sided as they could maybe seem. There were moments, and cricket is a game that just hinges on moments anyway, but there were moments that could have gone either way. Yes, Ireland looked like they were very comfortable, but watching, and especially watching with the Irish people, there were points of the game that could have gone either way. There was something hanging over, and we all know what was hanging over Zimbabwe, but it was very palpable. They've got the ICC meeting in 2 days that's going to literally decide their fate, their careers, their everything. That was like, you could feel that energy coming through on the field. They were low in the field from the first ball sometimes, even when they really didn't need to be. And it very much feels like there's discontent, not just with the board, but maybe a little bit in the dressing room. You mentioned Hamilton Mazakadza. It's not just been this series, though, has it? That's his first win as captain in, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I want to say like maybe 29 odd matches. That's a record for Zimbabwe. That is literally the worst record of a captain ever. It was a 0% win rate. And now he's won one T20, which is great. I'm not begrudging that, but it seems like persisting with a captain that you maybe don't need to persist with. He's not been in form for what, like the last 18 odd months. I don't think he's had a score over 30. I'm not entirely convinced he's the right skipper for the side. I saw him make a couple of decisions that I just thought he failed to bring on Sikandar Raza to a left-handed batsman until I want to say like the 30th-ish over in the second ODI. And I thought, what are you doing?
Yeah, he did keep him back, yeah.
He wasn't reacting to what was happening in front of him. His batting himself is just not coming off. And just comparing that to PJ Moore's very brief tenure as captain, he had 4 wins, I think. I think it was 100% win rate. So I don't know. I think that there's a multitude of problems going on with Zimbabwe, but I totally agree with you. They are still an excellent side. They're still a threatening side. If they didn't have the administrative issues hanging over them that they did, I don't think that tour would have gone just as poorly as it did go. There was also an element of some poor luck. I watched Kyle Jarvis bowl better than Boyd Rankin. And, you know, I spoke to a bunch of the guys as well. That energy was really hanging over them. And it's kind of their fates and their careers hanging in the balance. And for some of the guys, if it results in a suspension from the ICC, then that means their careers, you know, the likes of Brendan Taylor are what, like 33? If you have a 2-year suspension, then that's probably career over, or at least international career.
Well, yeah, as you said, the meetings are coming up, and just thinking about some of the other Zimbabwean players who have already, I guess, without a lack of a better term, sort of jumped ship. Blessing Muzurabani is a player that went cold pack this year. A number of players in the Zimbabwe setup have moved on and looked for a career in cricket without necessarily playing for the national team, which, to be honest, is quite understandable given a lot of these players' financial situations and amongst other things. So it is quite disappointing. I want to sort of move on. Nick, was there anything that you wanted to add? Sorry.
Just while we're on the younger crop of players, I was wondering what Tasneem made of Lorcan Tucker's keeping as a fellow, let's say, amateur wicketkeeper. What did you think of his keeping?
Wow. I watched him miss 2 regulation catches, which, as critical as that sounds, obviously can happen to anybody. But generally, it was okay. I do think Gary Wilson is better with the gloves, but I did like the decision to hand them over to Lorcan Tucker. Gary Wilson has yonks and yonks of experience, doesn't he? And that's just a totally different thing. But I thought it was a good idea to start that transition. His batting impressed me more than his keeping did. He had a couple of very mature innings where he played the situation. He didn't get carried away. And while wickets were tumbling, you know, at the other end, he really stuck it in to take Ireland to a respectable total. So it was definitely more impressed by the batting side of things. The keeping probably needs a little bit of work, but he's young, and it's going to happen. And I think with Gary Wilson as a mentor, then he'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah, well, that was my sense that as I said, as a very amateur wicketkeeper, I was very impressed with his batting, but yeah, his keeping. For me, he doesn't get low enough, and he sort of keeps his feet planted a bit, and rather than being more fluid in his movements.
Yeah.
And consequently, he sort of snatched at a few, which is why he dropped those regulation catches. So, I mean, it's pretty simple stuff. And as you say, if Gary Wilson's giving him some pointers, you'd think he should be able to fix it up. But yeah,
he's definitely not a ballerina.
Yeah. Hopefully he gets better.
So by the time that this goes to air and everyone listens to this, will be less than a week out from Ireland's test against England at Lord's, which does begin on the 24th of July. It is a 4-day test match against the English. Taz, being over there, what's the vibe? Do they think that perhaps they might be able to catch England after, I guess, a bit of a World Cup hangover?
Yeah, look, they've had a really good run in their cricket generally recently, and that test against Pakistan was a pretty decent showing, all things considered. They've also got a slight advantage here that it is the home ground for Tim Murtaugh and Sterlo as well. So nobody has more experience bowling at Lord's than Mertz does. So and he's just getting better and better with age constantly. So I think that they're feeling very pumped. I spoke to William Porterfield, and, you know, instantly there was that energy that he had. He was like, yep, our focus has just gone straight on to the test match. We're, you know, working as hard. We're prepared. We're ready to take the competition to England. And I think he felt that the reduction of what a normal 5-day match to a 4-day was something that they would take in their favor. They think it might throw England off their game a little bit. They've definitely got very ambitious plans, and they're working towards them, and they have a really good energy. And I think that those things all add up to good things. Self-belief is something that gets results, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's more than a chance that Ireland can pull up a result here. Watching Tim Murtaugh bowl against England in that one-day international and the one-day internationals against the West Indies as well, I felt that because he brings something so different, because he takes the pace off the ball a little bit and he kind of bowls these wobbling sort of in and out swingers, he does swing the ball both ways, he actually becomes a really difficult prospect. And on the first day with a new ball at Lord's, I can see him definitely doing bits. And of course, being a Middlesex player for so long, he'll definitely know Lord's like the back of his hand. on top of that, you've got Sterlo as well. And then looking back to when they played their home test match against Pakistan, I remember I watched every day of that match. And I remember Pakistan being 3 for not many chasing a small total. And there was every chance that Ireland could have pulled up something there if it weren't for a partnership. I think it was between Imam Al-Haq. I can't remember who the other player was. But you have to say that there's more than a chance for Ireland to do something.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And let's just look at the recent ODI at Malahide between Ireland and England. Again, England were the number one ranked ODI side in the world. Huge amount of experience and consistency. And that was a very scrappy, rough victory. That was all Ben Foulkes and Curran. One more wicket for Ireland, and I don't think that England would have won that game at all.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, it's just a matter of that gap that we always talk about between the top ranked, the first six and the next up until 12, 13. That gap is getting smaller and smaller every day, and cricket is a game that doesn't matter what you've been winning for the last 4 years, what's going to happen today? We just saw it in the World Cup as well. We saw Sri Lanka beat England. I don't think that even the most optimistic Lankan fans amongst us would have predicted that. So I think that Ireland have a great chance, and it's just about believing that for yourself and pushing England to their limit.
Well, of course, the test match does begin at Lord's on the 24th of July. The Irish squad, William Porterfield captaining the side, Mark Adair, Andrew Balburnie, Andrew McBrien, James McCullum, Tim Murtagh, Kevin O'Brien, Boyd Rankin, Simi Singh, Paul Sterling, Stuart Thompson, Lorcan Tucker, Gary Wilson and Craig Young. So looking forward to that, and hopefully for everyone but England's sake, they can pull off a miraculous result. Let's move on to the America's qualifier for the Under-19s Cricket World Cup next year. Basically a two-horse race, and Canada crushed the USA in the de facto final, the final day of league play, which the ICC tend to do. They chased down 113 and won by 5 wickets. It showed that perhaps the Canadians play a little bit more on turf wickets around with this tournament that was held in Canada, of course. Nick, I guess your Canadian-ness will come through here when you do talk about perhaps the Canadian side. They managed to thrash everybody until that final, and they were able to brush aside the US side that did look strong in their own right. But good to see two really strong under-19 outfits in Canada and the USA go blow for blow.
Yeah, it was a good final. I think you're overselling the Canadians a little bit. I mean, much as I'm liking you beating them up, but they were wobbling that, I think, 5 for 90-odd, chasing that 113. So, and, you know, as we've seen, once you start wobbling, often you can just totally collapse. So, yeah, saying they crushed them, I think, is a bit of a overstatement. But, yeah, as you say, they were the best team throughout. And talking to PDP, actually, he was the one who brought up this turf point. The US players don't tend to play a whole lot on turf, and the Canadians do basically their whole season. And so I think that is showing, especially on a ground at a King City, which is renowned for being, let's just say, not the most friendly ground. So they certainly have some experience with that. And we saw a lot of low totals, actually. And I think that is to do with the King City ground.
Yeah, it's an interesting pitch. It's a very interesting pitch. I spent time there last year for the GT20. And what I experienced was a lot of these massive players like your Warners, your Smiths, your Gales, your Afridis, guys who have a lot of experience playing on, you know, like what, places like the MCG and just high quality ICC pitches, had a very difficult time adjusting to the, what's the kind word, variable bounce, should we call it? And then, you know, guys like Rassi or Babar Hayat did a lot better. They just played the ball on its merits and they took their time and I think they didn't have too many prior expectations. And that works. So I think you're probably right that experience at a place like King City really, really matters. And of course, on the outfield, there's that little ridge that runs through from that flood that they had.
With the drainage pipes lying around, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it makes fielding not that easy as well, unless you know what you're looking out for, you have a little bit of an awareness of it.
I remember the GT20, because they played on that King City surface, the same wicket for days on end, there was so much traffic on it. It was so slow and low, and totals of 120 were easily defendable, because when there's just no pace from the bounce onto the bat, it becomes so difficult for a batting side to generate any sort of variable positions of where you hit the ball. And it becomes, I guess, a battle of attrition, even in the shortest format of the game. So for teams out here to play with tricky totals, I guess it puts a little bit more pressure on captains of these sides because they feel like they need to defend a smaller total when in actual fact, at times, it's just the slowness of everything. And yeah, like you said, Tasneem, it's very often you see it when world-class players come back and play perhaps first-class cricket or they play in competitions where the wickets aren't as conducive to batting. They find it really difficult because cricket's a funny game in that the higher you go, the facilities, especially from a batting perspective, they actually get easier the further you go through. So it's an interesting concept and one that these under-19 cricketers going through and playing international cricket for the likes of Canada and the USA, they'll actually find quite tricky to maneuver themselves in and around. And also perhaps too for some of the quick bowlers. And we saw Raj Vyas, who is a Chandler, Arizona local. He actually took 7 for 10 against the Cayman Islands with some of his left arm swing bowling. So he didn't really struggle generating anything from the deck. So we are seeing a few kids come through from this tournament, and hopefully we might see these names playing for senior teams in the not too distant future.
Yeah, hopefully they can keep hold of the talent that's coming through. You know, you look at someone like Karan Patel from the US who played under-19s cricket for them a few years back, and now he's swapped to baseball and obviously making a lot more money than he would playing American cricket. So this is, I guess, part of the challenge as cricket tries to grow in these countries is just keeping hold of the talent. And one of the problems, especially prevalent in the US and Canada, but I mean, this can go for other associate boards to a lesser extent, but I've definitely noticed it a lot more in Canada and the US, is that the selectors often sort of seem a bit wary of locally produced players, and they are disproportionately, I would argue, impressed by guys who have played top level cricket for a quote unquote test playing nation. So, you know, someone like, say, Xavier Marshall will just walk into the US team because he's played test matches for the West Indies. So, wow, oh, he must be really good. He is a quality player, but the fact that they're going directly to these guys who, you know, as soon as they're eligible, they fast track them in the team rather than showing a little faith in the local guys, I think is symptomatic of, I guess, the associate mentality that I think it's often unhelpful. And, you know, you look at someone like Faisal Jamkandi from Canada, who in 2018, he joint topped the under-19s World Cup wicket tally, but he's not been heard of since. But they have gone to a couple of, you know, they've got David Jacobs in and they've got Dylan Haliger from the Caribbean, and they've gone to ex-full member players ahead of someone like a Jamkandi who was a good talent, locally produced, you know, Canadian born and bred. And I think this is a problem within these countries a lot of the time.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And I think that some of it probably comes from some of the board structures as well. I don't think that they're particularly helpful. And they're definitely missing a trick on developing cricket domestically, aren't they?
Sure. Like, you look at this tournament here, even, and someone like Raqib Shamsuddin, who's topped the wicket tally for Canada and for the whole tournament. And, you know, Scarborough local, Canadian born and bred. Are we going to hear from him again? I certainly hope so. But maybe he's just going to fade away. And yeah, you really don't want this talent to just disappear, because these are the guys that are going to take the game forward in Canada rather than a, you know, 30-plus-year-old guy coming from a test playing country and giving you a couple of years of good service. I'm not, you know, I like David Jacobs. I think he's a really good guy and he's really committed to Canadian cricket. But, you know, how long is he going to be around as opposed to these guys who are, you know, sort of 17, 18, 20 years old and they've got their whole career ahead of them?
Yeah, I totally agree. Something that I experienced at the GT20 was that a lot of these local kids who have been born and raised in Canada have done a lot to service the game locally. They coach kids, they get like schools involved, they're doing something, they're doing their part to grow the game and make sure it stays outside of these traveling T20 leagues and competitions that roll around every couple of years.
Yeah, it's a perennial challenge, isn't it, that getting that, it's called imported or naturalized talent on the field to keep a team at a certain level to maximize funding, but what effect that has on the pipeline and inspiration or not creating aspiration for players coming through thinking, well, I be in the best five or six, because that's all that's going to be available in the teams for players that have turned up and naturalized. But having been in the middle of it, and of course seeing someone like Ryan Campbell picked for the 2016 T20 World Cup as an example, you know, it's never an easy decision to make, because you potentially put the national team performance to one side for local development. But if you don't achieve the heights that you need to sometimes to secure funding and even interest potentially from sponsors, there's that challenge as well.
Well, I guess a rival of Hong Kong, PNG, who have just come back from Samoa competing in the Pacific Games there in Apia. Both PNG teams, the men's and the women's, were able to get on the podium, with men taking out gold and the women, the Luas, taking out silver. We also saw Vanuatu on the podium, as well as Samoa. A few things to get through with this tournament. Obviously, a multi-sport games, so promoting cricket in a multi-sport event, which is a big tick for everyone here, especially Tim, who knows what that's like dealing with Hong Kong cricket. We've had some trouble, I guess, uncovering a few of the scorecards here, especially considering when they're full T20 internationals, except for the men's internationals where New Caledonia are taking part, only because the New Caledonia are not ICC members. On the men's side of things, PNG went undefeated with a 7-from-7 performance. They defended 137 in the final, bowling Vanuatu out for 105. Vanuatu were 1-for-63 to then lose, I think it was about 5-for-4. They were then 6-for-67 and struggled to fall, as I said, to 105. On the women's side, Samoa and PNG ended up level on the points table with 10 points. Samoa, though, were able to win the gold medal match by 4 wickets. The tournament also had to deal with a bit of rain. They had reserve days, though. Cricket World Cup, please take note. But yeah, fantastic to have cricket involved in a multi-sport event. And full credit to, I guess, all the cricket that was on show and being able to fit it all within the schedule as well.
Yeah, little nugget here. Former All Blacks halfback Afisa Tonu played for Samoa, and he's 49 years old, and he was part of the bronze medal winning side there.
That is a good piece of trivia. I don't mind that. Tim, obviously you've worked with Hong Kong a lot and dealing with funding and having cricket in multi-sport games and promoting that as a way of improving funding. Putting that cap on for a second, how important is it for teams like this to have cricket in the Pacific Games, because it gives them some more cricket to play, but it also helps their, I guess, their respective cricket associations getting some attention?
Well, yeah, it can't really be overstated just how important involvement in multi-sport games are. For a lot of these countries, the only funding that they get will be from the ICC, and generally what they can get from governments are linked to the Olympic committees. So somewhere like Hong Kong, its funding from the Hong Kong Sports Institute has a huge swing for when the game is an Asian Games or Olympic sport. And that's in sort of one of the more developed nations with established sports institutes and what I think similar in the South Pacific and beyond, where that's about the only chance you can get to unlock funds are when the multi-sport games are in the country's focus, and also gives you access generally to those facilities normally only for Olympic athletes. You know, we've heard stories and anecdotes before of how it would be for other countries like Brazil, even if Olympic cricket was even an 8-team competition, both for men's and women's, it wouldn't matter to a lot of countries whether they're going to make the final Olympic competition or not. The funding and access to facilities would be immense. I think Brazil were to receive €700,000 a year the moment that cricket becomes an Olympic sport, and that wouldn't be means tested in the sense that it wouldn't only get to them if they get to the final hurdle of getting to the Olympics and whatnot. So considering all the talk about cricket funding and where it comes from, it all trickles down from TV and media rights. You know, this would almost be free money for cricket that wouldn't have to come out of the pot that comes from media rights for world global events. But yeah, and the exposure to more games, subsidized matches for these kids and adults representing their nations that they wouldn't have otherwise got, just goes without saying how important it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that about almost in a way free money. Well, it is free money to the ICC, and this is one of the priorities on their scorecard grant is non-ICC funding and being able to access non-ICC funding. It's a bit strange that they are sort of dragging their feet on the Olympics when they say they want countries to raise their own non-ICC funds, and the Olympics is pretty much the number one way that sports can raise non-ICC funds.
Yeah, beyond running commercial events, and I saw on the recent scorecard, Hong Kong got themselves up to first, which is great with the income coming in for the Sixers and the Blitz. You know, beyond something like that or some great commercial partnerships, yeah, exactly, that funding's going to come from governments, whether it's all via Olympics or via other sporting divisions, or indeed through community partnerships or other companies with corporate social responsibility initiatives, which again are a key part of growing the development and awareness of the game in the community, about tapping into those corporate entities who are looking to invest in community development programs.
Yeah, I think also it would be nice if Australia and or New Zealand maybe sent a development side sort of thing to this competition, you know, because they do send some athletes in a sort of development capacity to the Pacific Games. And so I think it would be helpful for Australia and New Zealand to send some players to, yeah, give the rest of these teams some more exposure to quality opposition.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how we would go about it if we were to do it. I know that for the Australian Country Championships, the East Asia Pacific sent a team to that competition. So there is certainly, I'm sure there's certainly a way you could do it, perhaps an under-19s team or perhaps even an Australian country team. You might be able to find a reasonable way to fit it in. And you are quite right. Australia and New Zealand did send athletes over for the Pacific Games. Let's move on now, and with some preparation coming up for the Asia World T20 qualifiers, or the T20 World Cup, we should say now, with a change of name. Nepal have toured Malaysia and played a two-match series against Malaysians at the Kinrara Oval, which had two pretty decent turnouts for the two matches. Nepal had a pretty comfortable win in the first match, winning by 7 wickets, albeit with 9 balls remaining. Though were heavily tested in the second match, scraping through by 6 runs. I thought there were a couple of standout performances actually from the Malaysian side of things. I thought Syed Aziz looked quite solid as the left-handed opening bat for Malaysia, who actually scored runs in that tri-series they played with Thailand and the Maldives as well. Plenty of things to unpack here, especially looking at Nepal, but a 2-0 victory for Nepal, and they can, I guess, go into the qualifiers with a little bit of momentum going forward.
Bez, I don't think, geez, you made it sound like it was very comfortable in that first game. If it wasn't for Paris Kadke coming out and scoring, I think he got, about 40 off fewer than 20 balls. I think they would have really struggled there. I think the Malaysian attack, using spin from both ends very effectively on the home wicket, they were really impressive. So if it hadn't been for a Paris masterclass, I think we may have seen an upset there and knocking Nepal out of the top 10 in T20 rankings. It was really good to watch. And it's funny to be watching a match in Malaysia at Kinrara Oval and the only noise coming for when Nepal hits a boundary or takes a wicket. Just it shows the level of support that Nepal has all over the world.
Yeah, Nepalese fans are on a very different level, aren't they? I always thought Pakistani fans were passionate, but Nepal is just running on fandom.
Well, it really is with all their admin problems, but the game's just, yeah, as you say, just alive on the heartbeat of all those fans.
It's amazing, though. It's kind of what the game is about. So that's what probably attracts a lot of us to associate cricket, that despite the administrative issues, the problems where you think, are these countries ever going to get to showcase their talent on the stage that they deserve? You have fans that are so committed to the game, to growing it, so, optimistic, but it keeps you going.
Yeah, well, this is a team that when they get back from the airport, win, lose, or draw, they're mobbed by fans. You know, you can... I've bumped into people in Sydney while wearing a Nepali jersey, and people have asked, you know, why are you wearing a Nepali jersey, and explaining the story, and they're like, oh, yeah, Sandeep's good, but we love Paris Kadke. He's like our demigod sort of thing. Tim, you're actually quite right. I'm thinking about that first T20 again. Perhaps, yeah, Nepal weren't as comfortable as they might have seemed, but perhaps I was just so comforted in the knowledge that Paris Kadke was batting that I just thought that had he been not out at the end of the innings, they were going to get through, because I'm looking at the scorecard. Now
you're 25 million other Nepalese.
Yeah. Looking at the scorecard, only one other player had a strike rate over 100, and that was Rohit Podel with 5 off 4 balls. So yeah, you are quite right. Kadke hit 8 fours and 5 sixes in that innings, and yeah, for me it didn't really seem like that. But for me, the second match was quite telling of perhaps where Malaysia are at, more so than Nepal faltering. I thought Malaysia were excellent in the run chase and were very unlucky not to get there in the end. Nepal did limp to 173 in the end, thanks to some sort of late order hitting. Binod Bhandari hit 51 off 25 balls, I think, with at least 5 sixes, and Karan KC, I guess, coming through again. Interesting that they sent out him before Sampal Kami, who is perhaps a little bit more renowned with the bat. But again, I guess a few trials and tribulations still for Nepal with the top order. I know Gyanendra Mala He's really struggled with the bat in recent times, and they're struggling to work out what to do with the top order. Paris has opened with himself. They just can't quite seem to find an opening batsman, and that might be an Achilles heel, I think, coming into the qualifiers, because, you know, you really do need some top order hitting in that power play just to make the most of it. And then with the ball, I thought that the tried and tested and I guess the spin of Nepal that always seemed to sort of pull them through actually really struggled in the conditions. I thought, I know Sandeep Lamachane ended up with 2 for 38 or 4 overs. He took 2 wickets, but I've got to say, players looked quite comfortable playing the leg spin, especially Syed Azir's coming down the track and hitting straight and managing to find the gaps between sort of cow corner and cover. So there's plenty of things to discuss there. I know that they're in a little bit of a transition period with Shakti Gorchan moving on, and Basant Regmi at the end of his career as well, and a few young spinners coming through. So definitely a few sort of creases that Nepal needs to iron out. Where do we kind of sit with this qualifying in Asia? We know that UAE have already qualified by virtue of hosting it, but it could be quite a tricky proposition for them.
Yeah, I think you're right. This mini series here has shown, you know, Nepal are vulnerable against quality opposition, and you're right. Malaysia did use the home conditions very effectively. Their I guess fleet of spinners. That Kinrara Oval pitch is a little bit slow, and they exploited the conditions very effectively to really stifle the run rate. Yeah, if it hadn't been for Kadkar in the first game or Binod Bhandari peppering the cow corner boundary in the second, they would have struggled. And you saw the Malaysians sort of, they almost probably should have won that second game, I think. They just kept losing wickets. You know, everyone kept finding the boundary and they looked good, and then there'd be another wicket and the partnership would stall a bit and they just sort of ran out of puff. But yeah, worrying signs for Nepal. Kadkar, yeah, you're right. He dug them out of trouble with the bat, but he got hammered with the ball in that second game. He went for 3 sixes. His bowling, I don't know what was going on there. He just sort of trundled in and delivered it right into the slot. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where I don't think he really wants to bowl, and I don't think in most situations he won't bowl, but he's kind of there as another seam-up bowler if they need him. And yeah, when he does over-pitch, it's very easy to hit away. I was just thinking, Nick, someone like Sandeep, do you think he's played a lot of cricket in the last 12 months, but he also sat out the Nepali domestic 50 over competition? It's an interesting one. I'm not actually sure if he's played too much cricket or he's actually a little bit underdone now because he's been rested, but he just seems to have lost a little bit of consistency with the ball, and once he did get hit around a little bit, he actually found it quite difficult to get it back.
Yeah, that's what I was noticing. He'd come in and get absolutely tonked right back over his head, which, you know, no spin bowler really wants to happen. But then after that, he sort of was pushing it a bit faster and flatter and wider especially, which meant they could just milk him out through the offside, or even a couple of times the Malaysians were able to free their arms and sort of thwack him over extra cover kind of region. And you know, we saw that a little bit in the IPL actually, where he'd get hit around a bit and then sort of be chasing his tail in a way. You know, he looks like he needs to be on top to keep bowling well, which is a bit of a worry, because you know, if teams in this upcoming qualifier can get on top of him early, they might be able to neutralize one of the biggest threats.
So the 2019 ICC T20 World Cup Asian Regional Finals qualifier begins on the 22nd of July, and keep up with all the news and events from that tournament on Emerging Cricket. The teams in that: Singapore, Kuwait, Malaysia, Nepal and Qatar. The final day fixture, which is normally an indication of where the ICC sees, I guess, the top two teams, it has Nepal playing against Singapore at the Indian Association ground at Singapore. Perhaps a nod to them playing at home Singapore, every match being played on the same ground, with morning and afternoon fixtures again from the 22nd to the 28th of July. The UAE were supposed to be in that competition, but after they were announced as the global qualifier hosts, they went through automatically and will not be taking part. Some more T20 international cricket going on, and a little bit more for Nick Skinner here to talk about is the Denmark and Finland T20 international series. They played 2 matches, and just having a look at the 2 scores, there was a 1-run thriller in Bromby between obviously Denmark and Finland. Finland falling short by a run. And then in the second match, Denmark got themselves out of a spot of bother to post 124 and bowling Finland Finland out for 86. There was a stream for the two matches. It wasn't an interesting angle, so it was difficult to, I guess, make out some of the intricacies of the matches, but it was a stream nonetheless, and a 2-0 victory for the Danes, Nick.
Yeah, it was a good effort for them. They're a bit of a development squad, sort of. They had some of their first-choice players, but also a few new names to the team, and also a returning name in Aftab Ahmed. Yeah, good sort of seam bowler, Glostrup local, who last played for Denmark, I believe, in World Cricket League Division 4 in 2012, which was a while ago, and he came through the under-19 system before sort of dropping out of the game. I think it was work-related. But yeah, nice to see him back. And of course, that man, Nikolai Legsgaard, the tall left-arm spinner, kept things tight, closing out that last over. And, you know, with an economy rate of 3.25, 1-for-13, very difficult to get away. As I've said in previous podcasts, you know, he's very tall, uses the angles very effectively, and keeps things very tight. And yeah, as we said, he'd be a pretty good pickup for one of those clubs in the Euro T20 Slam if they were looking to have some European associates involved.
Yeah, I guess a solid performance for Denmark considering they did rest a number of their players, but good to see that they did provide some fantastic opposition for Finland, and Finland unfortunately falling short in both of those matches. Let's head across the Atlantic to the USA, where we've had some administration and coaching shuffles amongst a host of changes that are set to be made in USA cricket, of course, achieving one-day international status earlier this year at World Cricket League 2, which was fantastic to witness. Prabhudha Dasanayake has left his post as the head coach. We've also seen Wade Edwards move on as well. A host of changes, Ian Higgins coming in as CEO, amongst other changes. A lot to go through here. Tim, I guess you coming from a former CEO sort of background, you know what it's like, I guess, having sort of changes like this go on at the top. And where do you think USA are right now? Because they've obviously done all the hard work to get one-day international status. And now after a sweeping change, it must be very difficult. And there must be a lot of pressure on people coming in to emulate and to also improve on that success going forward for USA cricket.
Yeah, well, I guess I've seen it at the back end with when I came on as CEO of Hong Kong cricket, that they'd come from World Cricket League Division 3-2 and scraped their way into the World Cup qualifier and surprised everyone, maybe except themselves or maybe even themselves, to almost make the World Cup. But I suppose more importantly was ODI status and a spot in World Cricket League Championship and the Plus Intercontinental Cup. And that also meant a lot more funding. So they said, well, gee, we need to have a more professional structure and to get a CEO in and have a governance model a lot more robust, et cetera, et cetera. I think USA have gone through a similar change, this one a lot more planned, I think, because they planned for it to come in terms of getting a proper board, replacing USACA, of course, with the new USA Cricket, setting up the new T20 League, which was always going to be the backbone of the funding model in USA Cricket. Them getting ODI status is great for the sport and exposure, but I don't think that would have changed much from the T20 League point of view. But what you're seeing here is a new board coming in with new ideas and thinking they can do things differently and better than the team that are already in there, and bringing a lot of different views in that weren't there before. And it just looks like that view and plan, from a cricket point of view at least, is completely different to what was there under a very, well, skeleton staff almost with the USA. You know, there's a lot of talk about how much money had been invested into the game there, but ultimately there weren't that many people. You know, Wade Edwards, for example, I think it was wearing about 45 different caps there, from governance and administration, finance, coaching, fitness. So to see this sort of change that almost, well, didn't happen overnight. It sounds like there were a few conversations. And as we saw in PDP's column on Crick Info, that Ian Higgins had met with Prabhudha there to stay, but it all looks like there was no way forward. And I've got to say, I've got a lot of admiration for a guy that can be that successful. As you know, won World Cup games for an associate team, as we saw in our retrospective looking back to Sri Lanka, but to take teams like he has with Canada, Nepal and USA, and to be able to step aside with his head held high rather than staying there and just not being able to do things the way that he wants to. I hope that he only goes on to bigger and better things. Who knows where he could go back? We could go back to Nepal, or there are other teams in that league too that may want him. But yeah, I think just to sum it up, it's really just a fundamental difference with a new board trying to impose themselves and make a change, looking to do it very differently.
Yeah, I don't think Prabhudha is going to have any trouble finding another job. He's basically the associate world super coach.
Yeah, he's done it everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love for him to come back to Canada, but I actually did. I had a brief conversation with him in Namibia about his time there, and it sounds like it's a similar sort of thing as what's ended up happening here, and just administrators on one side wanting to do things one way, and Pabudu, you'd think they would have learned by now to trust him, that, you know, he knows what he's doing. But yeah, I don't know what's going on there. I think one thing that's interesting with the US situation is that, so the $1 billion investment there from American Cricket Enterprises, which is owned by Willow TV and the Times of India, it seems like the ACE people were pushing their view of where they want the game to go. And Pabudu obviously wanted to take the game in his direction. And this is a problem that we see sort of around a lot of these countries. Once there's some money involved, you know, a lot of these people start trying to stick their nose in because they can, you know, they can smell some cash. And I guess Afghanistan's a bit of an example of this as well. Is just, I think it's not very healthy to have ostensibly a sort of a investors or league sort of, or sponsors basically in function of, it's not very healthy to have them starting to try and, I guess, dictate how to run the cricket team on the field. And I think that's what happened. And I think that's why Pabudu left. He sort of makes it pretty clear in his interview with PDP that he doesn't want the, I guess, interference with his vision. And I think the US might be in for a rude shock if they end up playing against a team that has picked up Pabudu, because he's only going to make another team a lot better. And so basically it's their loss, you know, for not working with him.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think every time Pabudu doesn't like it, go somewhere, his team wins. So I don't know what it is, if it's a man management thing or if it's a technical thing, whatever it is, he seems to get the best out of his players and seems to get the best results out of his team. So again, as you said, I don't think he'll be out of a job too long. I think someone will be knocking on the door, and coaching jobs, the turnover is quite high, as we know from any sport. The coach tends to be a bit of a scapegoat in failure sometimes. So the merry-go-round will continue, and there's every chance that Dustin Iker will go somewhere in the near future. Well, as we wrap up today's podcast, we should discuss the Creo Cup that reached its climax on the 12th of July in London's Trafalgar Square. A huge amount of credit needs to be thrown at, well, multiple departments at the ICC for developing the Creo Cup and bringing it to not only associate members, but to full members as well. Six social teams from all corners of the world came together just before the Men's Cricket World Cup final for a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to celebrate diversity in the game. There were teams from Brazil, Rwanda, Germany, England, Indonesia and India for the tournament, which, of course, as I said before, finished on the 12th of July. Boys and Tasneem, it has to be said that although this was held concurrently with the World Cup, it's fantastic to have this and like to have a sort of inclusivity around cricket in the game, not just for the 10 teams playing in the World Cup, but stretching out to the far-flung corners of the world.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'd probably rather have a 16-team World Cup.
That's not what you said on other podcasts we heard, Julian.
Oh, are we still going on about that? I was underslept and I was trying to be less of an asshole than usual, okay? But I did like the inclusion of Brazil and Rwanda and Indonesia and, you know, a lot of cricketing countries that probably don't get anywhere near as much airtime as they should. And I really liked the social aspect of it as well. The community-based aspect, I should say.
Yeah, well, what we're hearing about this Creo project is that they're coming out with an app which will allow people to sort of find other cricket players in the vicinity and sort of get a match going, which I think is a pretty good idea. Was it Tinder for cricket? Was it you called it?
I did call it that, which is ideally what I would just like Tinder to do. But, you know, you can't have a perfect life.
Well, if you have a picture of you in your cricketing gear and a couple of Simpsons quotes, I think that's perfect, isn't it?
This is why we can't have nice things. Swipe right if you want me to be in your cricket team.
Please select me, sir.
I am an all-rounder.
But yeah, like I think that is a really good idea, and I think it'll if it gets going, I think that could be really beneficial for the game in a lot of these countries where you might have trouble. You know, you might have some cricket fans, but who don't know that there are other cricket fans around, and so I think it's a very interesting project, and I hope it goes well for them. Although, as you alluded to there, Taz, I think it's somewhat ironic that they're running this
while reducing the actual World
Cup. Yes, concurrently with reducing the actual World Cup to 10 teams. It's a classic case of the ICC sending mixed messages. Although, I found interesting the teams that they included, you know, Germany, Brazil, Indonesia, Rwanda as associates, because those are all countries that I think the ICC do have their eye on in terms of demographics and more so in the case of Rwanda, the story behind the game. And so I think it's pretty telling that they're focusing on those associates.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what we want to see more of. But rather than just maybe going after a broadcast audience, which is what I feel that this is. If you play cricket with your friends, then maybe you will watch the World Cup being played in Australia, England, India, Australia, England, India, again and again and again. It would be nice if we actually promoted the game as a form of professional concept within these other countries too. It's nice. It's like things that we've seen before. It's about like street cricket and or whatever people call it in their respective countries, tape ball, whatever. But it's not about the professional aspect of the game, which, you know, we have 105 cricket playing nations, and it would be great if other people knew that. I was at Essex for a county championship match the other day, and like the members know me, they know, you know, that I work in associate cricket, I do comms or whatever sometimes, and they asked where I'd been, and I told them about Ireland and Zimbabwe, and I promptly got like a little bit of a lecture about how good it was that this was only 10 teams, because it meant that it wasn't boring, the World Cup, I mean. That's not how I felt about the World Cup. It's not how it works. It had some phenomenal moments and it had some really, really dull games as well. And it definitely wasn't a case of the dull games were the guys who were ranked lower. Afghanistan took India further than any of the sides apart from England and New Zealand did in that knockout game. So it's not like that. And then I got a little bit of a thing from a new member who was like, oh, but you're American. They don't even play cricket. And then I have to launch into my, actually, sir, I think you'll find that they do. But it would just be really great if it wasn't always a, well, actually, conversation and people knew. One of the comments that I got about the 10-team World Cup is, oh, well, it's only the civilized nations that are playing it, isn't it? Because they're all Commonwealth nations, or mostly anyway, they're Commonwealth nations. So it's just a reiteration of really boring conversations from boring dudes that you've heard your entire life. And fun as the Creo Cup and maybe the Creo app, which is Tinder but for cricket, might be, it would just be good to see a genuine World Cup. I'm still in this place where I talk to people from other sports and they're like, but that's not a World Cup. That's like 10 teams. That's just X, you know, English Empire, British Empire countries. And they're not entirely wrong, are they? Apart from Afghanistan, but they're not entirely wrong. And that's just getting a little bit boring.
To be fair, England did try to invade. They just failed.
Yeah, repeatedly, again and again and again.
And also, the US earlier this year actually thumped a county side, Lancashire, in a one-day game. So, you know, you can... If you ever make it to a Lancashire game, you can give them that back to them.
A bit of a news roundup. The T20 Slam Draft will be going on as people listen to this, so we'll wrap that up next week. Former Irish international and New South Wales Blues coach Trent Johnston has been announced as the Hong Kong coach. Johnston takes over from Simon Cook, who vacated the role. And finally, we'll go over some Afghanistan shuffles. Of course, we've seen Rashid Khan has now been appointed captain of Afghanistan across all three formats. It comes after a host of changes in Afghanistan cricket. Asghar Afghan will deputise in all three formats once again. In some more Afghan news, Aftab Alam is banned from domestic and international cricket for a year due to multiple breaches. Boys and Tasneem, we might have to end today's show there. To keep up with news from Cricket's New World, make sure to follow Emerging Cricket on your favourite social media platform. And please make sure to give us a positive rating wherever you are listening to your podcasts and whichever of the 70-plus countries you're listening to the podcast. A massive thank you, whether it's online or, of course, on 91.3 FM in Perth, Sport FM, that is. Thanks a heap to Tasneem Samarkand for spending the best part of 2 hours with us. Taz, thanks a lot. What have you got lined up for the rest of the day? A long day at work?
A long day at work, guys. I'm off to Canada on Friday. So, and then I was just in Ireland last week. So apparently I'm going to have to start showing my face in the office at some point.
You sound like Tim Cutler, actually, with all this travel as well. But again, once again, we do thank you immensely for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
No problems. You're welcome anytime. And again, massive thank you to the two men who stick by me on these long nights of recording, Tim Cutler and Nick. Boys, thanks very much.
Good to be here as always, Bez.
Always a pleasure, Bez. And I've got to say, we're getting better at this. This recording for an hour only took 3 hours.
Yeah, you guys don't want to know how long the or some of the other podcasts have gone. But once again, thank you to everyone at home or wherever you are, in the car or out and about listening to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. But for now, from us, enjoy the rest of your day wherever you are around the cricketing world.